Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by Maeve McLennigan from the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, a not-for-profit organisation working across the UK to uncover stories in the public interest and hold power to account. Maeve joined the Bureau from the Greenpeace Energy Desk, having written for BuzzFeed UK, The Guardian, the BBC and Vice News. She also hosts the Tip Off podcast, lifting the lid on some of investigative journalism's biggest headlines. The recipient of the Bar Council's Legal Reporting Award, she's also been nominated for a plethora of other ones, two Amnesty International Media Awards and the Orwell Prize for Exposing Britain's Social Evils. Maeve, thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Wow, you've been nominated for a lot of awards. That's very impressive indeed.
Thanks. Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, it's amazing always to be on those shortlists. It's always against some fantastic journalists. So just to be in those categories is obviously great.
But quite apart from the kind of personal gratitude and the pride that you might feel, it does show that, you know, the power of investigative journalism and frankly, what a good job you're doing.
Absolutely. And it can be really important when it comes to, you know, funding and things like that to kind of hold those up. It can also be really important when you're trying to convince people to talk to you, to kind of show them some evidence of, you know, you are a serious journalist, you have this kind of CV that's out there. And yes, and it's just great, obviously, for the industry to kind of show that intention and that focus on a really important area of journalism.
I think the problem with investigative journalism, though, is it's very expensive. Hardly anyone wants to pay for it these days. And although when you do the big reveal and expose someone as a wrong, and that's incredibly sexy and great, the actual process of getting there is long, convoluted, you know, even dull in a sense, that there's just so much legwork to be put in. How do you stay sane during the process?
Yeah, absolutely. And for all those stories, you know, that you have the big reveals, there's 10 more that have fizzled out, that have gone nowhere, that have just died on you at the last possible minute. It's one of those ones, you know, I talk to a lot of investigative journalists now, partly through the Tip Off podcast and partly just friends. And I think everyone has this moment, as soon as one story is out, you have this moment of elation and satisfaction. And then it's almost immediate, that kind of gut-wrenching sinking of the stomach where you think, I'm never going to get a story again. How do I get back to that? You know, it's they can be months and months in the making and kind of obsessive. So yeah, there's definitely peaks and troughs. I feel like right now I've just come to you to the studio and I'm right in the middle of a pretty deep trough and trying to work out how to climb out. So it's you kind of just have to keep your eye on the prize, but also be aware that sometimes things don't end up being a story, and knowing when to drop things as well is quite important.
If this isn't a strange question, what's the mixture of emotions you feel at the end? Is the primary kind of thrill the story itself, or is it also that you've exposed some wrongdoing or brought a wrong un to account, as it were? I appreciate it'll be a mixture of both, but which is the kind of primary emotional note?
So personally, I got into investigative journalism because I wanted to do stuff that actually had an impact, that would make a kind of tangible difference in the world.
You didn't want to recycle press releases and do journalism.
You know, I mean, there's obviously entertainment value in that. And that's, you know, for lots of people, that's a legitimate form of the medium. But personally, I wanted to do it. And once you've done, you know, 6 to 8 months, you don't want it to be tomorrow's chip packet. You want someone to actually take note. So yeah, there's that excitement, there's the adrenaline that you don't often get in investigative journalism, of those last moments, which I'm sure daily news reporters feel all the time, of that stress of like, is the story right? We're going to get it out. Is it all laid out properly? But that's fleeting, and much more important to me, and I think to some others, is, you know, what happens next? Who's taking it up? Who's shouting about it in Parliament? What are the next steps that happen?
And do you feel a sense of duty to keep on something, even once you've exposed it, a kind of duty of follow-up to make sure that if Parliament has said they're going to do something about it, that you kind of hold them to account as well?
Yeah, and I think the further people get in their careers, the more juggling you have to do with that, because I know personally, you get so deep into a story, you really have to care about it to do 6 months, even if it's the most, what you think is going to be the dullest story. By the end of it, you really do care about it, or else you wouldn't have kept going. And it can be quite hard then, when you obviously have to move on to something else and people are still coming to you and feeding you things and trying to balance that out. You know, I did a quite a long time digging into what happens to asylum seeking children here in the UK. And that's such an emotive topic that it's also something that you don't just switch off from just because you've moved on to a different project. project. So it's really trying to kind of keep that balance of sometimes you can take that up and keep running with it, and other times you can direct people that might be coming to you to other journalists that are kind of writing on that on a more regular basis.
And how do the stories come to your attention then? Because you mentioned there about children of asylum seekers. I remember when the coalition was formed, and Nick Clegg said one of the first things he did was to stop the routine detention of children in asylum centres. And when I heard that, I thought, how on earth were we doing that before?
Right.
I didn't even know.
Yeah. So Claire Sambrook, who's at Open Democracy, had done some amazing work and won some awards for that. And she did incredible things there. Things that often there's things going on that people in whatever industry it might be know that's happening, and they kind of assume that everybody does, and they don't really know that it's a story, and the rest of the wider world might be scandalized if they were to find out.
But I also felt lazy as a citizen hearing that news, that I ought to have known and been outraged earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. I know, I'm exactly the same. And you know, also as a journalist, and you think there's still stories to this day that I think like, oh gosh, I really should have been onto that as well. You know, I was so close, and just you don't get that initial bit of information that sparks you off. But part of the job is reading between the lines of stuff that you're seeing and asking those questions of like, what is going on deeper then, and what needs to be looked into and dug into.
And do you have a hidden list on your iPhone, as it were, of people you're going to go after in the future, or topics you're going to address, things that come to you? Because that was going to be one of my other questions is, you know, how do these things come to you? Is it just in every aspect of your day-to-day life? Or do other people bring suggestions to your attention as well?
Yeah, there's a whole range of ways that you can come across stories. And actually, making the tip off, it's been fascinating to me to hear from other journalists about where they come from, because, you know, it might be in the case of like the Panama Papers, you get this amazing huge leak, but that's pretty rare. Much more common for me personally is that you're kind of, you know, reading the papers every day and you see something happening, and then that starts to kind of spark off a chain reaction, or you're talking to people just out and about on a completely different topic and they say, by the way, did you know this might be happening? You know, Heidi Blake from BuzzFeed, her amazing story that she did about Like a Mobile and what looked like money laundering there came from the fact
all
that
those vans driving around London,
which is just incredible, and the way they followed it up was absolutely fascinating.
She just noticed that there was a lot of vans delivering a lot of money and thought, that's odd.
Yeah, she was in a pub with somebody talking about a completely different topic, and they said, oh, by the way, this other thing, and she was like, that's the story. And sometimes people don't see that themselves, and it takes that kind of news hound nose to kind of sniff out, oh, actually, that's the one that we need to go after.
And presumably, though, you must be frustrated sometimes when you know a group of people are doing something wrong, and for whatever reason, legal, evidential or whatever, that you have to drop it. That must be frustrating. I mean, if this was an episode of Scooby-Doo, they have 100% success rate at the end. The villain is always outed. He reveals his intentions and then we all move on. But do you know of kind of wrong-uuns that are getting away with it right now?
Yeah. And that's really frustrating. And sometimes you just don't have the necessary body of evidence to properly firm it up. And that can be really frustrating. I think often people keep that in the back of their mind and might keep an eye on those things. But also sometimes there's so many other stories out there that you could spend your entire life trying to get this one thing, and actually you're wasting time when you could be doing 10 other equally important stories.
But that must require quite a lot of emotional discipline on your part, that you have to kind of park one injustice while you pursue others.
Yeah, and editors can be really helpful for that, obviously, that you get that direction from above, and often they are, you know, one step removed from the story, and they can advise and say, look, it's just not going that way. By the same token, though, you know, I've spoken to lots of people, and I think I've had it myself, where you just have that thing in your gut where you know something's happening. And even when editors say, come on now, move on to something else, you might keep squirreling away in your evenings and your weekends. And sometimes it's that tenacity that pays off. And other times you get to the point where you just think, I mean, either it's absolutely not provable or the story wasn't there in the first place.
Does it ever work the other way, where sometimes you're even slightly more cynical than you need to be? I was thinking about this. The taxi that dropped me off here, that he gave me the change from his wallet, and I actually thought at the time, I thought, that's irregular. And then I thought, why do I even care where the taxi driver gave me my £5 note back from?
Yeah, totally. There can be times when you're kind of always weighing up the scale of things, and you're weighing up like what might already be out there and who else might be already on this, and if it's even worth your time. And yeah, so there can be times when you hear what sounds like a tip and you just think, you know, that's been done already. Then you might see somebody else do it a year later and actually no, it was worth retelling it and revisiting, and that could be frustrating, but that's kind of how you learn.
Can you talk me through as best you can some of the processes involved? I mean, a lot of it is data journalism? I mean, mining tranches of documents and data. Do you own a trench coat and some dark glasses and you kind of stand on the corner outside an office noting comings and goings? You know, what is the actual mechanics of investigative journalism?
Yeah, I actually bought a trench coat about 3 years ago and everyone just made fun of me. I had to stop wearing it. I looked like that news hound in The Simpsons and I had to stop. But
Kent Brockman.
Exactly. Quiet, the dog's barking. There's a kind of whole range of different methodologies available and you can use lots of them in, you know, you can overlap different methods, or it might be that one particular story lends itself to a particular type.
Like the Panama Papers was just how good are you at searching the database?
Right. And again, tenacity in that case, you know, other people that might just get bored of looking through reams and reams of paper, but some people, they, you know, like Holly Watt, who I talked to about that, you know, just said if you're nerdishly geeky and you really like tax law, then actually that's the perfect pastime for you. So you kind of do it that way. So yeah, there's those kind of data tranches. There's, you know, there's people that can build all kinds of amazing data analysis tools. They can kind of map things in different ways that can reveal stories that you didn't necessarily know
were hiding there in plain sight.
Right, exactly.
But no one thought to ask the question in the right way.
Exactly. And you just, you know, there's an incredible amount of data that's out there that the government publishes and other people publish. And people just sometimes aren't always looking at it in the right way. So, you know, when I was at Greenpeace's investigations team, a colleague there did a thing looking at air pollution and just overlaying it with nursery locations. And then you have the most polluted nursery schools. And that's a really important story for all of the, you know, parents enrolling their kids in what is potentially an illegally polluted nursery. And both of those,
and a great PR hook,
right? And both of those kind of sets of information were out there. It just took that kind of investigative hypothesis to kind of think to overlay them.
What a clever notion,
right? It's really great when those things pay off. That's fantastic. And then there's other things like, you know, cultivating sources, just going out and talking to people, finding and encouraging whistleblowers and making sure that you do that in a really safe and responsible way. There's a kind of the pure shoe leather doorstep, going out and talking to enough people, knocking on their doors until they will tell you things. There's freedom of information requests. There's a whole array of weapons in an investigative journalist's arsenal that they can kind of draw on, depending on what the story is they're going after.
So in any one typical week or month, how many stories might you be working on? And I imagine they would often be at different stages. Some of them are in their infancy, some are about to close. And do you even know, as you embark on something, as you start digging, even how long it will take? Do you think, oh, this is a 4-week job and 2 years later you're still working on it?
Yeah, it can be really hard at the start too. I mean, often you kind of try and sketch out in your mind, these are the things that need to happen to make it work. Often every single one of those is going to take twice as long as you thought it was going to do. So I generally work on two kind of areas that I'm looking at once, sometimes more. When I was at Greenpeace, we kind of juggled a variety of different things. At the Bureau, it tends to be deeper, like you just focus on one or two things and you try and stagger them. And when you're in, you know, a team of investigative journalists, you can stagger your story so that there's not this kind of horrifying fallow period where nobody does anything for 6 months, but that, you know, there's a kind of consistent output of news. But yeah, things can take a lot longer than you think. Things that you think was just going to be a really quick FOI story might, you know, whatever you get back from that might throw up something completely new and fascinating. In the Panama Papers, for example, a lot of the Guardian journalists were saying actually some of the biggest stories they got really quickly. They then just kept mining for months and months and months, but they knew that in their back pocket they had that David Cameron was in there, that Putin's best friend was in there, these kind of amazing stories that you then sit on in that instance because you're kind of working on a big collaboration. So yeah, it certainly varies and it can be frustrating and you can lose sight of the light at the end of the tunnel at some points. And that's when it's useful to be working on more than one project, because you can kind of shift your weight a little bit and start to look into something else while something else is ticking over.
Are investigative journalists more altruistic than normal journalists, insofar as that you just said then about sitting on a story? You know, I know lots of journalists that would never sit on a story if 5 or 6 other journalists knew about it, because one of them will break the embargo. I mean, Piers Morgan famously broke the embargo on BBC Pay, only by a few hours, but he even had the audacity to call it a scoop, and it clearly wasn't.
Yeah, that was quite hilarious to be watching that unfold on Twitter.
Loads of journalists have a go at him, and he was very, very aggressive in his way back. Like, well, if you're stupid enough to respect an embargo,
I love that reasoning that he was just a better journalist by breaking something that everybody else had
respected,
and was holding on to. Yeah, there's quite a lot of trust involved there, and it's definitely the journalist nature to break a story. And you know, I've been working on really long things and then got scooped just, you know, days or weeks before it's meant to go out, and it's kind of soul destroying. But when you're looking at these big collaborative projects like what the ICIJ does, you know, I talked to a guy there as part of the podcast, and he was saying it was like that scene in Braveheart, that hold the line, like if one of you runs, that's fine, you're going to be the first one out the gates, but you're never going to make the same kind of impact as if the entire body moves with one movement. And I'm working now on a project at the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, which is all about working with local reporters and getting them to work together and working on big collaborative projects. So it's something that I'm now seeing the other side of, that kind of coordinating role of getting everybody on board and getting them understanding that you can have this information and we should share information, but we have to trust each other enough to say we all go at the same time, or else you kind of ruin it for everyone. And then you don't get the story again. You know, next time the ICIJ gets a dump of stuff or the Bureau gets something really interesting, it wouldn't get shared with people that had broken the embargo the first time around.
As a citizen, I'm grateful that there's still investigative journalism per se, because if you think about it, in the capitalist economy that we have, who would want to fund investigative journalism? It's incredibly expensive. Whoever's going to be the result of your endeavours is going to have some unwanted attention. It's incredibly long. As you said earlier, you could go down a certain cul-de-sac. You could legitimately look into something, spend weeks, and then conclude that actually you thought there was some suspicion of wrongdoing and there actually isn't. But it just seems to me the ultimate in kind of very expensive, very, very important, but nonetheless, someone's got to fund it, and very few people seem to be doing so these days.
Yeah, I think everyone would agree it's a really key part of
a healthy society.
Of a healthy democratic society. And in the US, for example, they have a much better culture of understanding journalism as a philanthropic pursuit. So the likes of ProPublica, for example, you know, it's all through kind of charitable grants, and I think they have charitable status.
And there's some great investigative journalism happening in the US, as you mentioned there.
Right.
Even USA Today, the New York Times, there's some fantastic work going on.
Yeah, and you know, the New York Times with their subscriptions going up, you know, people seem to be buying into the notion that if you want serious, proper journalism, you have to pay for it.
Well, we had Mark Thompson sitting in that chair a couple of months ago. He's the chief executive of the New York Times, and he said, actually, things have never been better financially for the New York Times because people want to fund them standing up to Donald Trump.
Right. And in the UK, it's a bit more of a complex scene. There's potentially many reasons for that. There might not be the same tax incentives that people might have for charitable giving in the US. We also have this quite well-known tabloid press that potentially people think of that as journalism, that kind of the phone hacking, that kind of scandalous behaviour, rather than the more public interest, serious, long-term stuff. So the Bureau of Investigative Journalism is a not-for-profit, and it you know, gets a lot of its money through grants from different foundations and bodies. There's also some really interesting new models. So there's the Bristol Cable and the Ferret, which are these kind of cooperative groups where, you know, they're working on very localised issues. So the Bristol Cable, obviously, just working on Bristol, but they are owned by their membership, and their membership will pay, and they have these incredible AGMs where everybody comes and they can feed into what kind of things they should be investigating and looking into. And that's a really interesting new model.
How does it work in terms of funding investigative journalism? Because I understand, you know, if I buy the Sunday Times, they've got the Insight team, my £2.30 or whatever it is funds that. I've got BuzzFeed, Heidi's doing a great job there, you know, but my clicks and it powers the adverts and blah, blah, blah. But then you get to something like the Bureau, you've got a mixed funding source, haven't you? How does that work? Do you kind of investigate five things, three of which are going to come to fruition, and then you sell them and they pay for the two that don't? Is it like a venture capitalist model? And people who donate, presumably, they do so without strings attached, otherwise you wouldn't take the money.
So the money that comes to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism comes from a variety of different grants and foundations. It was originally set up by a grant from the Potter Foundation, which is Elaine and David Potter. And Elaine Potter was an investigative journalist. She was on the Sunday Times Insight team back
in the
day.
She did the thalidomide investigation, didn't she?
Exactly.
Under Harry Evans.
So she had this real, you know, obviously she was very driven in the importance of what investigative journalism can do. So that was where that kind of funding came. When it comes to the idea of selling stories, I think that was something that the Bureau toyed with at the beginning, but actually now that doesn't happen at all. We just partner and we give away the stories for free. You know, there has to be proper credit. There has to be, you know, bylines for the journalists.
But how do you choose? That's an interesting conundrum, because you've got a genuinely amazing story. I imagine you've got a beauty parade of outlets that are competing for this great story, which is free to them.
Yeah, it's a great thing, I think, for all of those outlets to kind of have a fully formed story kind of arrive on their door. It can be really good. It's very much chosen, I think, on a case-by-case basis for where that story most belongs. It might be that we know that this is a topic that Guardian readers would be really into. It might be that we think, you know, that this certain outlet is going to get the most viewership on this issue. They're going to give it the best
impact.
Show. Yeah, impact. It might get, yeah, exactly. It might get, you know, under the nose of the right person if they're reading the Daily Mail rather than the Guardian. So it's kind of slightly, it's on a case-by-case basis in that sense.
And to state the obvious, though, when you're investigating people, they don't want that story to come out. So I imagine they go legal quite quickly. You have to tread very carefully in terms of not only the journalism itself, but also the way that you handle that. Because you wouldn't want a journalistically sound story to be bullied out of publication because their lawyers are more expensive than your lawyers.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was part of the concerns, you know, after the Leveson inquiry and Section 40 about what might happen there in terms of the power of people being able to kind of quash and kill potentially like really important investigative journalism just because of that fear of the legal threat.
It's probably the only good thing that came out of the ridiculous snap election that we've just had is that the government dropped it.
Yes, so in the Conservative Party manifesto, they said they were going to scrap that. But I think there's now concern that maybe they aren't as strong a party as they might have hoped they'd been, and that might get pushed down the pecking order. So I think people are still waiting to see exactly where we stand on that going forward.
That has to be abolished. It's completely ridiculous.
It's kind of preposterous, and it's really scary.
You could have to pay the other party's costs even if you were in the right and win the case, yeah, over a technicality of whether you're going to be registered with Impress.
Yeah, and for you know, places like the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, which, you know, we are robust financially, but it's a pretty small project compared to the Sunday Times or whatever. And a big legal challenge like that, you know, if we were in the right and had to pay out those kind of costs, would actually, that's a huge percentage of, you know, of the yearly budget. And that would be true of local journalism across the board, I would imagine. You know, the Yorkshire Post and others, Bristol Cable, could they afford to do the kind of investigations they're doing with that threat hanging over them?
How does it work when you scope a project at the beginning? Because there's a lot of unknowns, but do you kind of assign a budget? Do you think, well, this project's going to involve, as you said, some shoe leather, so I'm going to have to take 3 weeks, you know, actually going to this area, there's going to be hotels, petrol, you know, I can't go in my own car, you know, I have to go do this, that and the other. How does that work? Or do you just have a kind of bureau credit card? And
So I'm quite lucky, I guess, being the journalist end, that I don't have to worry too much about that. I can kind of say this needs to happen or that needs to happen. And generally, there's not a kind of like you have this finite budget to do this story. There might be stuff like, you know, if it was something that involved flying around the world 20 times, we might say we're not in a position to do that. Let's pass it on to somebody else. So you kind of work within your means in that sense.
So you've never felt tempted to expose local government wrongdoing in Tahiti, for example?
That would be nice, wouldn't it? That would be sweet. I could, you know, occasionally get to travel for stories, and that's always fantastic. But I know from past experience, I did a short stint at Barbados Today, which is Barbados's national newspaper, just when I was starting out. And that was beautiful. But when you're in paradise, there's not that many stories to do.
I can imagine.
Yeah. Another beautiful day. The sun has shone. Good.
Do you ever feel that the targets of your investigations are onto you at any moment, that there might be counter security measures, and that, you know, if I thought someone was following and watching me now, that would clearly be paranoid. No one's got any reason to be interested in what I'm doing. But people do have an interest in what you're doing and oppose what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know, you know, there's some cases when you're investigating really serious topics like criminal gangs, like you know,
your physical
mafia
safety
hits.
Is at risk.
Exactly. And you know, I personally haven't had many instances like that myself, but I know other journalists that have found themselves thinking they're being tailed and trying to, you know, lose someone on their way home to make sure that, or finding a car that's been parked outside their house for days on end and getting kind of suspicious about that. So yeah, it's absolutely not a career without some risks in that sense. But we are incredibly fortunate in the UK that, you know, compared to a lot of other countries in the world where journalism, you know, you can pay with your life, places like Mexico or Russia, you know, it's not like that. But by the same token, yeah, there's obviously, when you're going after really powerful people, they have the lawyers or they have the PR people that can kind of spin a story before you get there. You always have to go to them in advance to kind of lay out what it is you're going to say so that they have an ample opportunity to respond. And that can always be a bit nerve-wracking, because in that period, they could basically scoop your story and put out their own version. And, you know, there's always that kind of risk as well, I think.
Because there's always that risk, isn't there, in the interests of proper journalism, that you give the target of your investigation prior to publication the opportunity to comment and challenge any of your findings. But they then might just issue a press release straight away, coughing to it, just in an effort to kind of usurp what you're doing.
Yeah. And talking to, you know, Will Fitzgibbon from the ICIJ, when I was talking to him about his Panama paper stuff, they definitely got that. They went to the Kremlin and asked them, you know, we found these things in the Panama papers. And then the Kremlin, you know, went into full spin mode and started to come out and kind of undermine these journalists' reputation before the story even went out.
Are there good days and bad days then?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
There's you with the thrill of a scoop, and then suddenly they put out a press release saying you were wrong, and you must think, well, why do I bother sometimes?
Yeah, there's definitely ups and downs. I mean, I love investigative journalism, don't get me wrong. There's times when you can be in those kind of pits of despair and think, you know, that was kind of a lot of work for not a huge amount of payoff. It can be quite devastating when, you know, you've spent all this time and you really care about a project and it goes out on the day when something else happens and the story gets bumped and, you know, nobody's talking about it, or it goes out and it makes a splash for a day and then a week later nothing changes, and you can kind of be, it can be frustrating when you think, I've given you all the evidence you need to see that this is happening. Why aren't people sitting up and taking notice? So there's definitely frustrations. But
do you feel sad or frustrated being around wrongdoing itself? I mean, I remember a couple of years ago, Panorama did a show on abuse in care homes. And, you know, I'm glad I saw it as a citizen. It's right that those people have that wrongdoing exposed. But I also felt, and this sounds almost trite to say, but I felt sad watching it, knowing it went on. I'm glad that it was brought to everyone's attention, but I also felt worse off emotionally having seen it. Now, you could say, well, that's good because it shows that you're upset at injustice and therefore, you know, something will be sorted. But if you're surrounded by that kind of wrongdoing all the time, does that have an effect on you personally?
Yeah, by its very nature, I think investigative journalism is you're staring in the face of some really horrible things. And that's true of news reporting as well. You know, my friend went and covered the Grenfell fire, and I was so grateful. Like, I was obviously so appreciative that people went in and reported on that, but I was so grateful that I personally didn't have to go and watch people throw their children.
It.
Like, that's just horrifying. And I found myself, you know, for one project I did about this quite obscure law about joint enterprise in the UK, I read 800 or so court of appeal judgments, and that was just reading, you know, bits of paper. It wasn't actually seeing these things in the flesh, but essentially reading 800 examples of really terrible things that people do to each other, really horrible crimes, and that kind of stuff stays with you, you know.
It does, and my degree's in law, and I remember I'd studied joint enterprise quite extensively, and also you would read murder cases where the guy who stabbed the guy in a bar fight went to prison for murder, but there was a guy in the other side of the room that went out with him that night but wasn't actually part of the fight, that is also doing life for murder. And whilst he might have been a wrong un and involved in some way, he clearly wasn't as guilty as the actual murderer.
Yeah.
You end up feeling sorry for people like that.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's important to, you know, things aren't black and white and there's nuances in everything. And I think that's a great thing about doing an investigation, is you can really dig into that and you kind of have, by the end of it, you have a pretty comprehensive grip on where things are. So, yeah, we did this 8-month project at the Bureau of Investigative Journalism into joint enterprise and managed to uncover that, you know, data hadn't existed before. We managed to kind of show the scale of it. But for me, the takeaway point of that investigation were those human stories. You know, I went to visit this one guy in prison. He had taken no part in the killing that happened. He didn't even see it happen. He didn't hold a weapon. His friends ran around a corner and stabbed a guy. He was 15 years old, which was just out of the park with his mates. And he ended up in prison. I went to visit him there. And then when he was released, he went straight to Immigration Removal Centre because his family was Sierra Leone. And he's now been removed to Belgium, which was the first place they got refuge. So his entire life has been turned upside down. And that was one of those, you know, an example of a story where that investigation was done and dusted. But I really cared about what happened to him in particular. And I kept up with that story and kept in contact and kept reporting on it, even though it's not an investigation, you know, still to kind of say 4 months later, here's, you know, by the way, this was what happened next.
And I imagine the Daily Mail at the time painted it as kind of murderer, asylum seeker, you know, eventually removed and caged and all this kind of stuff. I mean, that must depress you as well.
Yeah. Totally. And, you know, especially with joint enterprise, it's young black boys generally, and they're kind of mugshots plastered around, and there's no kind of exploration of then, you know, several of those charges might be dropped against some of them because they actually, it turns out, they were all just scooped up in the first instance of the police investigation. And later it turns out that they weren't actually culpable. But, you know, this guy forever is going to have, in his case, it was manslaughter, but other people are forever going to have those kind of labels on them that you know, they are a killer in the eyes of the court. There's nothing you can do to kind of take that away.
And if you could call that kind of state overreach, when the police and the courts and the authorities get it wrong, it's always the most vulnerable in society that end up copping it.
Yeah. And but the great thing about that investigation was it sparked a select committee inquiry, and they looked into it. It was kind of talked about in Parliament, and then there was a Supreme Court ruling which basically said just that there's been this overreach for 30 years. This law has been overextended and overapplied, and they referenced a lot of the material that we'd found in that. So it's edifying when you kind of do that work, and even if it takes a while to actually start to kind of impact policy, it does have some kind of tangible result, if not for Edward Conte, but for others.
How cooperative or dismissive or obstructive is the state? Because there's different arms of it. Like, for example, you mentioned earlier about FOI. Do the authorities try to thwart those kind of investigations routinely? Or do you find that certain arms of the state are actually quite cooperative? You mentioned the Select Committee inquiry, because some politicians do want to be seen to be campaigning against these kind of things. So is it a mixed bag? Or is it generally that whenever you're going to come up against the authorities, whichever manifestation it is, they're largely going to be uncooperative and obstructive?
I think it is a mixed bag. I certainly feel, I mean, just anecdotally, that there's certain government departments that I'm more confident I'll get a response out of my FOI than others. You know, I've been in, you know, 11-month battles back and two with the Home Office to try and get certain data on asylum-seeking children out of them, stuff that should have come back to me in 20 days, and it just doesn't appear. But then you can talk to, you know, politicians, and they can put in PQs, or they can kind of bring things up in different ways and try and get information out. So you can kind of work with elements of the system as well. But yeah, it definitely varies.
Tell us about the podcast then, because it's widely regarded as the second best podcast out there.
It's going to catch up. No competition.
But tell us about the whole story. How did it come into being? For our listeners that aren't familiar with the Tip Off podcast, you know, what's it about?
Sure.
Start from the beginning.
Sure. So it's a podcast, so it's the Tip Off. Each episode takes a different investigation, and basically we walk through it and kind of tell the story of how it came to be from
the investigation itself.
Exactly. So from that tip off moment, every stage along the way. And it came out of a variety of different things. I guess it was, you know, talking to my friends that are investigative journalists, sat around in the pub, and them telling me how they got this story. I thought that, in a sense, is as interesting as the end product in some cases. It's almost like that, you know, the magic trick is amazing, but knowing how the magic trick happened is kind of equally fascinating. And I listened to a ton of podcasts, including your own, which is fantastic, and including a lot of US ones, shows like Criminal and Reveal, and kind of realised with stuff like Criminal, which kind of digs into different crime stories, they weren't always necessarily breaking new stories. It was more a kind of retelling a narrative of kind of talking people through in a different way. And then there was also this kind of context that we live in these days where fake news gets shouted about all the time. And that can be hugely frustrating as somebody that, you know, can spend weeks and weeks and weeks just to get the figure exactly right that's in the fifth paragraph that you will skim over. Like, you don't know the work that goes into some of those stories. So I kind of wanted to show people, lift the veil a little bit and kind of show people what goes into that. And then essentially they're kind of modern day detective stories, real life detective stories.
Thanks. I hugely enjoy listening to it.
It's been really fun. And for me to make it, it's been really interesting and useful. You know, I'm learning stuff from these people. I don't think you have to be a journalist to enjoy it. But as a journalist, I find it quite inspirational to think now.
I love this podcast because I get to speak to amazing people like yourself and then learn things every week.
It's great, isn't it?
It's great. An amazing privilege.
Yeah, no, totally. I love it. And I mean, journalism in general is great for just being able to, like, your job is to ask questions and learn things every day. That's amazing.
A kind of curiosity and nosiness. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. That's the best part of the job, really, isn't it?
Exactly. You can't be bored, really, once you have all these fascinating things to look into.
So how would our listeners tune into your podcast? What is the actual URL? How would they get in touch?
So it is on iTunes, it's on SoundCloud, it's on Acast. If you search for The Tip Off, we're also on Twitter at Tip Off Podcast, and The Tip Off Podcast is on Facebook. So there's lots of different ways you can look at it. I think people that listen to this, it would be the exact kind of people that might enjoy that too.
Absolutely. It's why we've had you on, because I listened to it. You mentioned fake news just then. That's interesting. Do you think that journalism is under attack more now than ever? Or do you think that because it's almost like the boy who cried wolf, everything that I've ever seen labelled as fake news by Donald Trump type people, including him, isn't fake news and therefore redoubles my efforts to commit to journalism? And it's when Donald Trump got elected, I subscribed to the New York Times, the Boston Herald, the LA Times. I actually started paying for more journalism because I thought it's under threat more than ever.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's also quite hard because there's such a plethora of news outlets now. I think there isn't those handful of really trusted central sources that people go to. So I agree. I think there's like incredible journalism going on. But I also am concerned that if you believe a certain thing, you can find what looks like a news source to support you. So you might be going to the InfoWars or the Fox News to kind of bolster what you already believe is true.
Exactly, just as reinforcement.
You know, and that's what, for me, it was kind of incomprehensible. I thought that the Washington Post and the New York Times had did such an incredible job of fact-checking and debunking some of Donald Trump's campaign promises that it seemed incomprehensible that anybody would, with that information in the public domain, still make the decisions that they did. But clearly, that information was not filtering through to everyone. I don't know. But I think as a journalist, all you can do is keep on going. You can keep making sure your journalism is robust enough. You can be as transparent as you can be by publishing, you know, if you can, transcripts of things, the FOIs that you got. You can kind of talk people through the methodology so that people can make their own decisions on what is a legitimate piece of news and what isn't.
When you think of, I'm going to generalise now, but when you think of the stereotype of an investigative journalist, you think of them as a kind of campaigning, lefty type person. I've got two questions. One is, are people like that stereotype largely? Or, you know, do you get right-wing based investigative journalists that want to challenge the status quo? And then my second question is, do you ever look into something that actually challenges your own conscious and unconscious bias, where you think, well, there can't be any wrongdoing there, and then you think, well, actually, I don't know that, I'll look into it. Is there anything where you almost go against your own grain?
Yeah, I think so. When it comes to kind of people's political persuasions,
are they all militant lefties, basically?
I don't think that's the case, no. And I think particularly with investigations, because so much of it is evidence-based. Obviously, it's one thing if you're a columnist, and obviously, like, a story can be spun either way when it comes to the publication and the editorial line that they have. But because you're basing it purely on fact, you tend to follow the facts where they lead, and you can't really predict where that's going to be at the start. Maybe at the moment it might seem like there's a more kind of leftist swing, but that's probably just because the powers that be are the Conservative Party. I'm sure if Labour were in power, then there would be the same scrutiny, and, you know, that's where we would be digging into. So I'm not sure there is that kind of, and, you know, the Daily Mail, the Times, the Telegraph, they have incredible investigations teams that are doing some really important stuff. So no, I don't know. I don't think that's the case.
Well handled, by the way.
Thank you.
If you were Christopher Hitchens, then you'd have said, do you have any sensible questions?
No, I mean, it is an important question, you know, where obviously there's an element of what you choose to look at has some inherent decision or bias behind it, that you just consider that an important topic to look at. But I don't think you could decide that you were going to reveal a thing and then go out and definitely get it, because from experience, it just doesn't work that way. You might think you're looking at one story and then it actually takes you on a complete tangent and you end up talking about something completely different. And yeah, that can, you know, you can be challenged in your assumptions that you hear things are going on, and when you look into it, that's actually just not the case. And that's when it comes down to having that evidence base, that you can't just say, oh, I'll write a story anyway because five people have told me it. It's like, if you don't literally have the evidence, then you don't do the story.
Is there a kind of an agreement of a moral framework that you guys operate on, insofar as even whether you think someone is wrongdoing? Like you mentioned Heidi's investigation earlier about Leica Mobile, but you could argue that, you know, it was the actual impact on society was just a tiny amount of loss to the exchequer. Don't get me wrong, I think it was a great investigation, but do you ever get that where someone might even argue about the morality of it, saying, well, if they want to deal in cash, and it's up to them, isn't it? It'll just let them get on with it.
I think you make an assessment of the public interest of the story. So in Heidi's case, you know, while there was this alleged wrongdoing, what was at the heart of the story was that they were the Conservative Party's biggest donor, and potentially there wasn't the checks and balances going on there, that, you know, if these concerns about this company had been raised in the past, which they had been, was it right that then that the Tory party should continue to take money from them? So in that sense, that's why there's a public interest in doing that. Another story we looked into was Claire Newell talking about the work she did at The Telegraph about British football. And you could say that, you know, football, it's a hobby, it's a pastime. I know some people don't think that, but is there really, you know, when there's children dying in Syria, is that where you should be focusing your attention? But again, you do the kind of public interest of, you know, if this is an arena in the UK where there is so much money, then
there's dishonesty and potentially corruption.
Yep. Then that, you know, there is a strong public interest there that should be brought to light. So, you know, interest from the public is different to public interest, but there has to be some element. So, in a sense, there's a kind of moral decision made at that point as to whether this is something that the public deserves and should have access to.
Is there an element of kind of almost like who watches the watchers? Because you're an investigative journalist and I'm holding you to account, albeit indirectly and poorly, actually, by coming on this podcast and you're shedding light on it. But would you ever look into other investigative journalism outlets if you felt that they'd been compromised in some way? I remember once, famously, that some of Julian Assange's posse wanted to leak some WikiLeaks stuff on WikiLeaks, and he refused. And I think that was, people said, well, that is the utter, you know, rank hypocrisy on his part.
Yeah.
Because he should be able to expose even wrongdoing at WikiLeaks.
Right, and you know, I'm really grateful for Private Eye that they're one of those kind of few voices that does keep an eye on what's going on there. Yeah, and there has been, I mean, there's been stuff recently. I think there was an article on BuzzFeed, it might have been a US site, about what happened at the Guardian US. So there's a certain amount of kind of people keeping an eye on each other. But it's tricky to do because, you know, you're often focused on something else. And certainly from doing the tip-off, it's fascinating to hear kind of people's different methodologies. And because it's such a secretive industry in a way, you often don't know what people are working on, so it's quite hard to watch what they're doing, because by their very nature they're having to be slightly clandestine in their kind of approaches.
We've got a few minutes left, so could you run through some of the stories that you worked on that have made you most proud?
Sure.
Great question, that, isn't it?
Just brag a bit.
Tell us why you're great.
So I really loved doing this joint enterprise one, partly because it felt like a thing that some people knew, but it wasn't the obvious story to go down because it was about really horrible crimes. I did another big investigation looking at a British company that was embroiled or part of a South African massacre that happened when mining platinum workers went on strike, and the company, which was London listed, you know, through their actions potentially exacerbated things there. And that was really interesting. I got to go to South Africa and talk to people, but also it was a lot of putting together court records and looking through financial plans and seeing, you know, what had led up to this, which was really fascinating. This current project that I'm doing now at the Bureau, which is all about invigorating and empowering local journalists, is really amazing. I'm really having a really fantastic time doing it because I think local journalism and local investigations are so, so important to holding power to account across the country. And
I was a local councillor for 6 years. The only thing I was ever scared of was the local paper.
The local press.
I wasn't scared of the chief whip, the leader of the council.
Right.
They would argue with me anyway.
Right.
The local political reporter was someone that I was desperate to go for a pint with.
But if now resources are being cut and staff numbers are being cut, then potentially, you know, there isn't that fear doesn't exist anymore, because if you as a local reporter have to pump out 5 stories a day, you don't have much more time than to just kind of write up press releases or do those kind of really quick turnaround stories. So this project is an attempt to facilitate those journalists to be able to dig in a bit deeper so that we can do some of the kind of heavy data crunching, the heavy lifting on that side of things.
And does it worry you in principle? Sorry to interrupt, but does it worry you in principle that a lot of local councils are putting out information sheets that look at first blush to be newspapers, and they're doing a little bit of local journalism, but clearly they're not going to challenge what the council are doing because they're not independent of the council?
Yeah, and that's tricky because you can see in a place where, you know, if your local newspaper is closed and there absolutely is no other source, then it is, you know, they can cloak that in a kind of, this is useful information that we need to get out somehow. But obviously there's an inherent bias there in where that's coming from. And they're not going to look into other things that potentially would hold them to account. But you do see these kind of hyper-local blogs now popping up, and they're taking up some of the strain of that, of kind of digging in and looking at things. But yeah, I think, you know, it's part of this fake news thing as well, that it becomes very easy to shout fake news if you feel so disconnected to the media world because it's all here in London. Then you just think, you know, I never see stories about my hometown. How can I possibly believe that what they say is going on in Westminster when I know for a fact what's happening down the road is this, and nobody's reporting on that or challenging your assumptions? And, you know, part of it was, I thought, in the wake of the EU referendum, a question I had was, did people across the UK really have access to the information they needed to make that kind of decision? You know, they could be being shouted at from by the papers and by politicians in Westminster. But, you know, if you're up in Northwich and Cheshire, do you have the resources that you need to fully understand what that means for you in your everyday life?
My worry was more profound, is that no one even changed their mind at the minute the referendum was called. I don't know a single person in my real life that actually changed their mind.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
or even was prepared to change their mind, frankly.
Well, and potentially that's a concern, but yeah. And I
think to be given the chance, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and just to have some of the, you know, if you felt one way or another, to have some of your assumptions challenged. You know, I tried now to read more of different papers or, you know, outlets, or, you know, in the US, I try and check on what's happening on Fox every now and then just to get an alternate viewpoint, and then you can make a decision. But if in your local area you had, like, specifically this is how this is going to impact, and, you know, there was some good fact checking going on, but I'm not sure that was happening in an applied level to kind of local resources. So yeah, this Bureau Local team is a really exciting new way to try and fill some of that void, and to not replace local journalism by any means, but to kind of facilitate and collaborate and work with these amazing journalists that are out there so that they can do those kind of stories.
Last question then, in two parts, is on optimism. How optimistic are you as a person, and has that changed as a result of your career? Like, are you more cynical? Are you more optimistic generally? Or are you the same as you always was? And also, how optimistic are you for journalism itself in the future, in the medium to long term future?
I think I got into journalism with some quite high aspirational kind of thinking that I wanted to change the world, and if I just did the right story, people would really take notice.
Or Woodward Bernstein type thing.
Yeah, exactly. That kind of thing. And there's elements of when your story goes out and people don't, you know, real change doesn't happen, you think, could I have made better use of my time of those 6 months by actually, you know, doing something else? But I think deep down, I still believe that if people have the information in front of them, then the right decisions get made. And at the very least, voices get heard that wouldn't otherwise be heard by doing those kinds of stories. You can kind of play into that kind of proper democratic society by making sure that everybody's getting heard. By that same token, I think, sorry, just to go off on a tangent, but I think that it would be great that there was a wider diversity of voices in journalism itself. So part of what we did in the first series of The Tip-Off was try and give women a platform, just because journalism is often, investigative journalism can be seen as a kind of rough, tough male pursuit. Actually, I think some of the best people doing work in the business today are women: Heidi Blake's, Claire Newell's, Holly Watts, Alice Ross's of this world. But it is also predominantly white and it's predominantly middle class. And then you're just missing a whole tranche of stories from society that you know, people don't hear about because we don't have the contacts. So yes, so optimistic in some ways, but also kind of aware that a lot needs to be done to kind of branch out. And I think I am optimistic.
Is that muted optimism?
Yeah.
Optimistic fatalism? I need to think about that.
Maybe I just can't be a pure optimist.
And your prescription or your foretelling of the future of journalism?
It's going to be a tricky road, I think. I don't think it's all glowing. I know that there's a lot of people that really want to do important stuff and are going to make that happen one way or another. But there's a lot of challenges right now: funding models, diverse sources of people that are kind of spinning stories a different way. I think, because I'm just a hopeful person, that I hope that we'll forge a path through that. But there's certainly challenges and hurdles to be faced along the way.
Maeve, that was a hugely interesting conversation. I've learned a ton. Thank you ever so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
A Right Angles podcast in association with Big Things Media.